This is an ABC podcast.
Waltzing Matilda, Waltzing Matilda.
For many of you, when you hear John Williamson sing Waltzing Matilda, you might think of the Wallabies. But for students in one regional Queensland high school, the song is a cue for a school lockdown. We're going to have more on that. And as the weather heats up across northern Australia, crocodile farms are going about one of their most dangerous jobs of the year.
Every now and then they do chase us out of the enclosure. Most of the time we can control the situation, but sometimes if they're quite feisty, then it's not worth our life and we have to bail, regroup and try again.
I'm Sinead Mangan and this is Australia Wide. Here on Australia Wide, we've been covering serious bushfires around the country since early September. And the bushfire emergency has only escalated since then. Thousands of volunteer firefighters in regional areas have already offered their services for weeks and they'll be called upon again in the coming months. But how far can you push Australian volunteer firefighters? David Gossage is the president of the Association of the Volunteer Bushfire Brigade of WA, and he also sits on the Council of Australian Volunteer Fire Associations. We're only halfway through December. How concerned are you about the demands on volunteer bush firefighters right now?
Oh, everything is cyclic, and certainly, you know, across this land, the spirits of volunteers are quite high. But like everything, if you're relentlessly going day in, day out without a break, there comes a point where you hit a point where you actually need a break. So, you know, I feel for the volunteers across Australia that are, especially on our eastern seaboard, here in WA, we've got our own large fires that we're contending with as well now. They've all started popping up. So it's something that's always plays on our minds across Australia as being a real issue. And I suppose it ties into fatigue. And the consequence of that is your mental health issues that volunteers get confronted with from time to time.
You've been in contact with the Prime Minister's office around how volunteers are managed. What issues have you raised with them?
We've met, from our perspective, with the Under-Treasurer about getting tax concessions for volunteers. And that's what I mean by that is, you know, say up to $1,000 tax concession on their rates for the volunteers, what we call frontline emergency volunteers who do more than 20 hours of that work a year. And we've certainly had those discussions with his office. Naturally, it's a very challenging issue for any government, no matter who's in power. When it comes to giving tax deductions, it's never really a friendly topic to discuss, is it? So I'm sure we're still exploring those options there, and I'm hoping that with the commitment of the federal government that they will take this matter seriously, given the amount of impost that there is upon volunteer firefighters across Australia.
Tell me how that would work. How would tax relief work for volunteer firefighters?
Well, it would just give them an opportunity, because what a lot of people don't realise is the amount of hours that volunteers put in. It's not just responding to the fire. And sadly, we only ever see in the media the big flames and exhausted volunteers. There's the other side of what volunteerism is, and that's what they do before they go to a fire, which is all the training, administration, and those personal skills development. And then post the fire is the rebuilding with their community. And what a lot of people don't realise is the volunteers are actually helping. Once they put the fire out, they then go back and help their community rebuild after the devastation. So in the terms of that, $1,000 being able to write that off on their tax is a very small token of gesture that the federal government could do to support the wonderful volunteers that put their lives on the line and put themselves between the fire and a total stranger. I think that's not much to ask at a federal level for that sort of support.
Small businesses often carry the load with freeing up people to go and fight fires. People who are volunteer fires, volunteer firefighters, they often free them up to do that. How supportive are small businesses of volunteers? Do you find that most businesses allow that to happen, or is there pushback?
So you've got a spectrum of small businesses across Australia, and we know that small businesses are the backbone to the Australian economy. They're the biggest employer across Australia. And as you can appreciate, small business caters from a self-employed person like myself through to a small business that maybe employs up to 20 people. But when you've got a small business, if you take one person out of that business and you've got contracts that you're trying to meet, that's a huge void and a huge hole. And the consequential effect on that on the employer, it could mean they could lose a contract. So it comes a point in time, especially when you're going day in, day out, where the employer needs some form of compensation. So if they let the person go, there should be a scheme like they've got with the reservists or the jury duty type scheme, where the employer can actually be reimbursed for that volunteer's time so that they can bring somebody else in to fill that gap, or be compensated for that loss of revenue for that period of time that employee would normally do. But be very clear, the volunteers make it very clear to me that we're volunteers, we don't want to be paid. However, we would like some form of tax concession or our employers being compensated for their loss wages and time should they be without us for a period of time.
In New South Wales, we've heard today that firefighters that had been made redundant have been called back to fight these current fires. When you look across the season, as you said, in Western Australia, it's going to be a very hot weekend and there's already fires burning. Do you have concerns about our ability as a nation to fight bushfires this season?
No, not at all. The community spirit always shines through. I've been through this cycle before in my career, doing this as my, when I say career, I'm volunteer career, where we've had years, a cycle of really bad years where there's fires all year round, and then we go into a lull, like in WA, we've been in a lull for the last 3 years. Looks like this year's going to be one of those peak years. We find that people in the community always step forward and provide the right support, and we always get through. That's what community is. That's what volunteerism is. And I don't support the notion by some industrial bodies that we've got to have more paid people. What we need is a balance. What we need to be doing is reversing the industrial view of centralised control being the be-all and end-all. It fails and will continue to fail. What we need to do with is focus on building community resilience, local level support, resourcing the local level, not at a state or federal level. We need to be looking at empowering our communities with the right equipment, right support, so that they are prepared at that local level. Because if you do that, the flow-on effect of that across the nation would be so positive that you would never have an issue.
You're listening to ABC Australia Wide.
David Gossage, the president of the Association of the Volunteer Bushfire Brigade of Western Australia there.
This is ABC Australia Wide.
And you're with me, Sinead Mangan. Queensland students have been forced to urgently find shelter more than 250 times in the past 2 years as schools grapple with threats within their communities. During these school lockdowns, students are told to hide under desks, avoid windows, and stay quiet until the danger has passed. This story from Alex Hyman and Owen Jack.
New figures released to the ABC by the Queensland Department of Education show 267 lockdown incidents reported by schools since the start of 2018, with over 200 of those occurring outside of Brisbane. School lockdowns are done for a number of reasons: a trespasser on school grounds, a police standoff in the area, dangerous weather events, or even the sighting of a venomous snake. Queensland Teachers Union President Kevin Bates.
I guess it's a sign of the times and the sorts of issues that our schools are coping with. that we've moved a long way from the days of a simple fire drill. And now there are a range of procedures that relate to various critical incidents that may occur in a school, such as issues to do with people coming into the school who have no right to be there, so trespassers. That may involve, for example, people with weapons. It may involve circumstances where there are altercations between individuals in the school grounds that relate not to the school, but nonetheless present a threat to students and staff.
Kevin Bates says the growth in school lockdown incidents is a reflection of society more broadly and declining behavioural standards around school grounds.
I think it's a sad reality about the communities in which we live. You know, there are every day in our news, there are reports of all sorts of violent circumstances, whether that's road rage, domestic and family violence, which has you know, been on the rise and is very much in the sights of governments around the nation in terms of trying to deal with that that particular issue. There's also, I think, a general decline in the respect for community members of the fact that our schools are and should remain places where inappropriate behaviour is simply not acceptable.
Sunshine Coast private school principal Colin Mink said he'd not triggered a lockdown since taking on the role 5 years ago, but drills were critical for the school.
Our lockdown drills are part of our emergency procedures, and we need to make sure that we've got the whole school ready for evacuations, and also in the event that we have a lockdown, that they know A, what the procedure is, and B, what happens at the end of a lockdown, because that's just as important. And so we have at least 4 to 6 practices a year in relation to the lockdown emergency procedures.
Colin Mink's School of Emmanuel Lutheran College includes an early learning centre with children as young as 2, right up to seniors preparing to graduate. The school encourages older students to guide younger students when the signal for a lockdown is played, a tune familiar to most students on campus.
It's always a little bit tricky to find exactly how to trigger the lockdown, so we've decided to use Waltzing Matilda as the song that is recognised to trigger the lockdown. And then all teachers and support staff and students know that they need to stay where they are or move to the nearest point of refuge.
Clinical psychologist Shona Innes says safety drills are not new for schools, but the nature of the threat has changed over the years.
Well, I think these days we're much more aware of things like domestic violence or there have sadly been some violent attacks or violent threats to schools. Most of these go, thankfully, under a lot of people's radars because there are some really hard-working people in schools who work with the emergency services to keep schools really safe at all times. But I think it's in this day and age, it's we're lucky that it's not like it is in the United States, where they have had some terrible, terrible situations with gun violence in schools over there. So much so that they've had to introduce more than just lockdown drills for many of their schools. So the nature of the threats to children at school has changed from just fire to now things perhaps like domestic violence. There might be someone who has an issue with somebody at school or is trying to get access to the child or children at school, and so they will turn up at school and they might be very threatening and wanting to disturb the peace at school in order to get what they want.
Out on the school ground, Year 11 student Hayden Morris says the drills have become routine since he joined Emmanuel Lutheran College.
For me personally, I'm used to like the whole drills and all that. I've done a few in my time, but I think for new students it may be a bit alarming at first, but then they warm to them.
Do you think they're important?
Oh, I think they're so important. I think it's great to like prepare the students in case something, you know, dangerous does occur at one point.
Year 11 student Hayden Morris sending that story from Alex Hyman and Owen Jacques.
You're listening to Australia Wide.
I don't want to put a killjoy on their fabulous family tradition, but
it was just mayhem and chaos.
The majority of them are still buying their trees, regardless of the snake.
So this is the first time we've opened the slide this summer.
On ABC Radio.
Students with School of the Air don't get to see each other very often, so when they do, it's a big deal. Teachers, students and their families from the Broken Hill School of the Air travel for miles for the end of school year get-together. And our reporter, Saskia Maben, went along to chat to them.
What's your favourite thing about school?
Maths. Because if you didn't know maths, you wouldn't know how many sheep went on the truck.
At the Broken Hill School of the Air Swimming Carnival, children swarmed to the microphone, keen to be interviewed about their favourite subjects and plans for the holidays as school wraps up for the year.
Really, it's really fun. You get to have fun. You get to see all your friends and have fun.
How often do you see your friends?
No, not much at all.
All right, favourite thing about the school?
English.
Do you have a favourite book?
Ella and Olivia. It's about two sisters that have lots of adventures and fights sometimes.
Do you have a sister?
No, I have a brother.
Tell me your favourite adventure to have with your brothers.
Well, when we go out, check the sheep with Dad.
And what's your name?
Ava.
And where do you live?
Mallorilla Station.
Now, what are you looking forward to most about the holidays?
I think going home. We do have two pens with chickens in there.
One topic was taboo. The teachers requested that the drought not be brought up in conversation with the children. The principal, Kylie Green, said it's not a topic that they need to be quizzed about. Miss Green has had a busy couple of weeks. I caught up with her at Christmas in the Park in Broken Hill.
We had our preschool and kindergarten orientation days, well, mornings, for our new students for 2020. And now this is our official start to the week, so our Christmas party in the park. So the kids will get to share presents in their class groups. They'll have Kris Kringle, they'll have preschool to year two, we'll get book awards, Santa comes, there'll be a barbecue, there's ice cream, so it's a bit of a party. The kids are in their party gear.
And there's a lot of kids here that are probably from, you know, lots of stations around Broken Hill. How far do people travel to get here for this week?
Yes, so we've got students who are north of Broken Hill, so close up to the border, in Queensland border, and then we have some families who are probably 3.5 hours south of Broken Hill as well, so lots of southern and then all in between, so from all over.
And what about your staff? Are you having many changes to your staffing now that it's the end of the year?
We have one new member joining us next year, but other than that, we're pretty stable at this point in time. Okay. Yes.
So you're not experiencing any problems attracting people to come out and work in these areas?
No. We sometimes we're the opposite, being a bit more unique. People do like to come and join us and get to experience school in a different context and a really different environment. And the kids are different to regular school children in the sense that they have a whole life as well that makes them. Their characters are a little bit different to school children in town, so it's a lovely experience for teachers as well.
While the teachers may still be hard at work, the students are ready to clock off for the year.
What are you looking forward to most about the holidays?
Probably not doing school.
Saskia Maben there speaking to a student excited for her holidays at the Broken Hill School of the Air Swimming Carnival.
You're listening to Australia Wide.
I didn't know Melbourne much. I knew where the racecourses were.
I'm making signs for the sleepy lizards.
Basically less eggs this year than what we would have expected.
The houses that are near the edge of the bush, they might encounter a snake up to 4 times a year, a death adder.
See how it goes.
On ABC Radio.
And you're with me, Sinead Mangan. As the weather heats up across northern Australia, crocodile farms are going about one of their most dangerous jobs of the year, and that's collecting crocodile eggs. Croc eggs are collected from captive adult crocs, and the eggs are then incubated, they hatch, and the babies are grown to a certain size and farmed for their skins and meat. Matt Brann went along to a farm near Darwin to get a very up-close look at how the job gets done.
G'day, I'm Carla. I'm from Crocodilus here in Darwin. And we're here today about to collect some crocodile eggs from a nest.
We're out the front of a pen. Tell us what's going on here.
All right, so currently what we're doing is we're trying to tire out the male. So we have a large, nearly 5 metre saltwater crocodile that's in the water, as well as the female that's guarding her nest. So it's a fine line between tiring him out without stressing him out, but we do want him to get a little bit, exhausted, that way it's a little bit safer for us to go in there, less chance that he's going to eat us.
because, you know, it's not a massive pen, and there's two crocodiles in there that I assume are not very pleased with the idea of you going in there taking eggs.
No, not at all. So the female definitely doesn't want us to go in there and take the eggs, and the male probably wants to have us for breakfast. So, it can be a bit tricky having two crocodiles in there. It is quite a small enclosure. So that's what we're just trying to do, is get them into the water, and that opens up the access towards the nest.
As I'm standing here talking to you, you're leaning on a large wooden oar. What's this for?
So this is the only thing that we really have to protect us from the crocodile. So if that male does start charging at us, all we need to do is give them a light tap on their nose. It's really just a tap. It's not a hit. Their nose is quite sensitive. And then they should retreat into the water in a perfect world. So every now and then they do chase us out of the enclosure. Most of the time we can control the situation. But sometimes if they're quite feisty, then it's not worth our life and we have to bail, regroup and try again.
I'm just looking at this wooden oar. It's got a few bite marks in it.
Yeah, it does have a few chomp marks in it. So the thing is, you just want to give them that light tap. The problem that can be is if it grabs that oar and does a bit of a head shake, they'll throw it out of your hand. So then you're in the pen with the crocodile and no oar. So that's the last thing that we want to happen. But that has been where the chomp marks have come from in the past.
During the course of the year, there's all kinds of jobs to do on a crocodile farm. Is this the most dangerous one?
Yeah, most likely. Probably this, and then crocodile relocations can be pretty dangerous as well. I guess this one's definitely up there because you've got both the male and the female, and it's both breeding season. The females are very protective, but at the same time, this is the funnest time of year. It's what we all love doing the most as well.
Well, you've got your blue esky with some straw in it. I think you're getting the all clear here to enter the pen. Am I allowed to come in as well? Should I come in?
It's up to you if you want to, but yeah, it's definitely a part of the farm. We'll just wait for Liam here to go in. He'll get the crocs back into the water, and then once it's nice and safe, we'll head in there and start to collect those eggs.
Righto. Alrighty. Here we go. Entering the pen. Carla is digging through a nest of dirt and straw. Liam is guarding with the wooden oar. And can you hear that? That's my heartbeat. She's just gone up a little bit. They're proving a bit tough to find, these eggs, Carla.
That's just a little bit tricky because pulling that straw off the top, you need to be careful that you're not going to roll any of the ones that are underneath. So that's probably the hardest part with the egg collection, is whatever position you find the egg in, it must stay in that position. If you pick that up and roll it, you've potentially killed that embryo on the inside because it will detach from the side of the shell. So now that I've just uncovered it, I'm going to check the temperature. So we want it to be sitting probably around 32 degrees. The issue we're finding this season is because we're lacking rainfall, the nests are getting really hot. So this particular nest, we can control the humidity because we do have sprinklers. But out on the river, some of the nests are getting up to about 36 degrees, which is just going to cook those eggs if we don't get them out straight away.
So is that something that we're likely to see in the Northern Territory this year, out in the wild, a lot of nests just frying?
Yep, 100%. So it may not be a good season for crocodiles this year. It's hard to know just yet. Some areas have got some rainfall, but there's also other areas that we are desperate for it. So the females can hold off laying for about probably 10 days. After that 10 days, though, they're desperate to lay and they'll just drop them if they have to. But yeah, they're holding off hoping for that rainfall to come, because even they know that's the best chance of survival for those eggs, is having that humidity.
And you've got the pencil. Oh. Here we go, we've got to quickly leave here. That's the female.
You're right to go back in.
All right to go back in. Now, these are destined for an incubator, is that right?
Yeah, that's right. So by us incubating them, we're giving them the best chance of survival because we can control the humidity and the temperature. So in the wild, only about 25% of eggs will actually hatch. A lot will get predated, others get flooded out. So this is a much better chance for their survival.
Getting croc eggs from a small enclosure like this or getting them out in the wild, which one's more dangerous, Carla?
I would say definitely in the wild. The reason being is these crocodiles, we know them, we know their behaviour, so they're somewhat predictable. You'd never trust them, you'd never turn your back on them. They can always act differently each day. But in here, it's a much more controlled environment. Out in the wild, you don't know how many crocs are out there, you don't know their temperament. And yeah, in here on solid ground, out in the river, sometimes you might be on mud flats, or you could be, you know, on a floodplain or vegetation that's going to make you trip up. So that's probably the trickiest thing, is if that crocodile does come at you, you've got the chance to run out of that enclosure without tripping on anything as well. So inside here, it's nice and open. So I'd say it's probably a bit safer being here inside the enclosure.
I'd be running pretty quick. That's Carla Pound from Crocodilus Park near Darwin speaking to Matt Brann. And that's all from the Australia Wide team this week. We'll be back again next week. I hope you have a lovely weekend. Cheerio.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.